State officer in need.
What's up, guys? It's Matt from the 1078 Project. Hey, if new to the organization, a little bit about us. The 1078 Project is a nonprofit organization that's been founded and developed by law enforcement officers who've been involved in critical incidents and officer-involved shootings. Our goal at the 1078 Project is to provide mental, spiritual, and practical support to law enforcement officers as they navigate the difficult times surrounding an officer-involved shooting. With that being said, let's dive into today's episode, and I'll see you on the other side, boys. What's up, guys? Welcome back to the podcast. Today's guest is an Army veteran with a tour to Afghanistan. After leaving Afghanistan, he continued his service to his community by becoming a police officer in North St. Louis County. During that time, he was in a proactive unit that focused on narcotics trafficking. He was also involved in several critical incidents while he was in that unit. He later left North County and moved out to Lincoln County, where our paths crossed for the first time. While he's in Lincoln County, he was involved in an officer-involved shooting, and he was one of the first officers that the 1078 Project had the pleasure of serving. He has since then become a giant proponent for the 1078 Project and also has become one of my really good friends. Today's guest is Greg Beninati. What's up, guys? Welcome back to the 1078 Project podcast. Today we're here with Greg. What's up, man?
Hey, how are you, brother?
I'm good. It's good to see you.
Likewise.
It's nice to have somebody that our project actually served on the podcast. It's pretty awesome. I'm super excited to interview you. Luckily, we've kind of become friends through this whole process. Absolutely. And you've helped me and helped me serve other guys, so I'm appreciative of that. I know you said you listened to some episodes, so we'll get right into it, and we'll dive right into who you are as a person.
Sure.
Did you grow up in St. Louis?
So I was born in Florissant, unincorporated county, St. Louis County, out till about third grade, and then we moved out to O'Fallon. So,
were you in a Catholic school like every other kid?
But I've been a Catholic since I was being Sicilian. You don't have a choice. You're born and raised Catholic, you know. But no, I went to public school. My parents have five kids, so there wasn't a bunch of money to lay around to send kids to private schools, you know.
Yeah. Where are you in the five?
I am number four. I have three older sisters and a younger brother.
Goodness,
yeah,
man.
All in 7 years.
So thankful.
All in 7 years.
Really?
Yeah.
There's 7 years from the oldest to the youngest.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. My poor mom.
Poor mom.
I know.
She's busy.
Like, Dad, chill out.
Yeah. So you grew up in. So your first couple years were in Florissant. You moved out to. Did you live out in like where in St. Charles County did you live?
Right off of Canost Road.
Okay.
Avondale Heights, which now cuts all the way through to Highway K.
I know what you're talking
about.
You go to public school there, too?
Yeah. Went to Zumwalt Middle Schools and then went to Zumwalt West High School.
Okay, cool. Growing up, did you like play any sports or anything?
Yeah, growing up, pretty much my main sport was wrestling. My dad was a wrestler. Got me started wrestling when I was like five. Started out in North County and then came out here and just kept wrestling and got into golf, obviously, because that's who doesn't. But, yeah, I just say I'm a wrestler, so.
Yeah, dude, you're built for wrestling.
Yeah, I guess. I'm not built for basketball, so. Yeah.
Which weight did you wrestle?
Oh, it just depends, man. I mean, growing up, I was a little guy. I was in high school, I was a little guy. Freshman year, I was 112 for varsity, and then sophomore year, I went down to 103. Actually won state that year as a sophomore.
Really?
And then my junior year, I think I was up to 119.
Just missed each other then. You must have been a weight class above me. So I think you're like 2 years older than me. So I wrestled 12. I wrestled 103.
What school?
Timberland.
Very cool.
Yeah, so I wrestled my freshman year, I wrestled 103, then I wrestled 12.
So you know Monteith and Killian?
Yeah, I wrestled with Derek.
Yeah, I know those guys.
Yeah, I wrestled Eric too.
Yeah.
Like Greg, Amos, I wrestled with him.
Yep.
Yeah, I wrestled with a bunch of those dudes.
Yeah.
Did a lot of like camps and stuff with them.
We
traveled over the summertime.
Right.
Wrestling together.
Yeah.
I can't remember. What school did you say you went to?
Zumwalt West.
Zumwalt West. Who else was it from? There was somebody from West that was really, really good
too. Oh, man. We were one of the best teams in the country. It was me, Warner, Wiest, Wolframs, the Colley brothers. We went years undefeated in duels. We should have won state as a team several years in a row. I think at one year we were a nationally ranked team. Like, it was
really,
yeah. I mean, my sophomore year when I won state, we had 6 guys in the state finals.
No way. I don't remember West ever like kicking butt like that. Maybe.
Oh man, we were.
There had to be like a disconnect. There, you had to be like a year. Well, I think you're 2 years ahead of me.
Yeah.
What year did you graduate?
7.
Yeah, you were 2 years ahead of me. So, I was just really getting into wrestling. I didn't start wrestling until my freshman year.
Gotcha.
But I picked up on it relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And I quit all other sports to wrestle.
Yeah. That's what it takes.
Dude, it's the, in my opinion, I think it creates better human beings.
No questions asked. No questions
the
asked.
Mentality that it takes to stand out on a mat and decide you're going to fight
absolutely.
With somebody.
Absolutely.
It was a game changer. So.
Yeah, the discipline and just what it takes to compete.
Yeah, I wish I would have started wrestling younger. Yeah. I really do, because I think I would have been. So by my junior year, I think I teched the dude that was ranked 5th in the state.
Yeah.
So,
That's 3 years of experience.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I wish I would have started younger. I think I would have been a lot.
For sure.
I think I would have been really, really, really good.
Yeah.
But that was like something we never did. Like,
yeah.
Growing up, I grew up in North County. It was like everybody played. You played soccer. You played baseball. Like all the church activities were like what you did, you know?
Yeah.
So what'd your dad do for a living?
My old man, he retired from Schnucks. Yeah. He, you want to talk about, what a man is. That's my dad. I mean, he worked for Schnucks, raising 5 kids, and then every day, as soon as grass cutting season started, him and my Uncle John, they'd be gone from 2 o'clock till dark for months and months and months cutting grass. So he did what he had to do to provide for us, you know.
Did mom stay at home?
For the most part, I think she cut hair every now and then, but just a hard working person, you know, and that's what he instilled in me. So
so he's with Schnucks for like 20 years or something.
Oh, like 40 years.
Really?
Yeah.
Actually, dude, that's like a weird thing. You're like not the first. I can't remember who it was. Somebody else came on the podcast and they were talking about that. Like, Schnucks used to be like you could start your career there and end your career there.
You could, but now it's not as family oriented.
Yeah.
The Schnucks family, you know, they're kind of weeding out from what I hear, and you know, you get these kids out of college that change the environment, so it's not what it used to be, not even close.
Yeah, that's sad.
Yeah,
is it cool to have like a company like that where you can start your career there and end your career? That's what I really looked for in a police department too. I wanted to start my career at one police department and my career there.
Yeah.
So your dad worked, mom stayed at home most of the time. Was anybody in your family involved in law enforcement or
no? Nobody. Yeah. It's the weirdest thing, man. You can ask my mom. I would just be a little kid, and I'd always have the show Cops on.
Really?
Just like a, 'cause I know it's a cliche, but I swear it's just like a calling, you know?
Really?
Yeah.
Was there anything that you remember that kind of drew you to it?
In a weird way, I think I was coming home from a wrestling tournament, and I was already home, and I think my dad was coming home on his own time, and he was at a gas station, and remember seeing the car flying next to him going around the building and cops chasing him, and he said he just saw the big old shootout between the cops bad guy. Yeah, and ever since then, I just kind of started watching the TV show and just fell in love with it, man.
No way.
Yeah.
So I grew up in, like, unincorporated St. Louis County, North St. Louis County, and when I was, like, I want to say I was, like, maybe 6 or 7. We lived in a pretty rough area.
Where at?
Like Delwood area.
Oh, yeah.
So around there.
Yeah.
So like not like a city creek or not like a county creek, like, but like a city creek, you know, like a big culvert.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a culvert, and then you came out of the culvert and there was like a park. It was like a park that kids didn't go to, you know, like,
right.
It was like a park that people sling drugs out of.
Right.
So like, it had swings and stuff, but it was like within walking distance of our house, but we couldn't go there.
Yeah.
There's like a pursuit, home invasion. Dude ends up coming out of the city creek, runs across the park, and ends up in my front yard.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so he meets my mom taking the trash out, and he's like, "Hey, lady, can I jump your fence?" And my mom's like,
"Can
sure.
I jump your fence?"
Yeah, yeah. At least he was polite about that.
Yeah.
My mom's like, "Sure." He jumps the fence, and there's a police helicopter.
Yeah.
And my mom calls bird. Like 911. Are you guys looking for this guy? Like, yeah. The whole St. Louis County SWAT team showed up to our house.
Damn.
Yeah, and then, like, I'm, like, looking out the window. It's, like, all these dudes are,
right.
like, freaking tech gear. They got bad, awesome guns and everything. And I'm like looking at them like from that moment on. It's like, oh.
Absolutely.
Man. And like St. Louis County, they used to like cops used to come around and give out like pop rocks and stuff. Yep. Like, so that was like where my obsession with law
absolutely,
enforcement came
man.
From. After that moment, I was like, I think I want to be one of those guys.
That's right.
Like, I want to be one of those guys.
Heck yeah.
So, did you go to college or anything? Or
no, man. After high school, I went into the Army. Spent 4 years there in active duty.
We talked off camera. Your family, I guess, has like kind of a line of military service.
My papa, he was in the Army. He was in Battle of the Bulge, and my grandpa, he was in the Army. He was in the Korean War. They were both infantrymen, so I just gravitated towards that too, you know. So I want to, and like I said, I remember being in seventh grade, and I didn't even know what the Twin Towers were, but I remember being in social studies class and getting sent home early and turning a TV on and just seeing people stomping on the American flag and burning it, and I just was infuriated from that moment on, and I just knew I wanted to get some revenge.
Yeah, so like that patriotic nature was kind of passed down from
for sure.
Pawpaw to through your family.
Which is wild because my Nana and Pawpaw, they came over from Sicily when they were like 12 years old, couldn't even speak a lick of English or anything like that. And years later, he's, you know, fighting for the United States. So
it's so awesome. Yeah. Man. It's like when you think back, when I think back to like what America was built on.
That's the greatest generation.
Yeah.
No, for sure. No questions asked, you know.
Yeah, I think so too. So is that why you chose the Army?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's why I chose the Army, man. I just wanted to be, in the Army and be an infantryman, and I wanted to deploy. I deployed to Northern Afghanistan in 2010 with the 10th Mountain Division. It's a pretty good deployment. We were in Kunduz Province. And we went to a lot of untouched areas as far as, like, Taliban strongholds and trying to clear out some remote villages and stuff like that so people could, you know, live a peaceful life. Seen my share of combat. My first firefight was about a week in, and we were on this dirt road. It was notorious for just being infested with IEDs because it led to where we were trying to get to, the village of like Ishikan and Gortepa. Nobody had ever been there, so they were definitely ready to go. I remember being in I was a SAW gunner, so I was an M249 gunner when I was over there. And my first firefight, man, I remember sitting I was in the back right of the truck. And let me back up a little bit. That night before, we were spending the night with the local Afghan police because we would do missions with them and stuff, and we got called out for we were the QRF quick reaction force, and there was an SF team that was in a pretty good firefight, so we were the ones to respond and help those guys. And I remember my gunner he was getting after it. It was a firefight, and I wasn't out of the truck yet. I kind of wish I was, but there was an armored truck in front of ours, probably like, man, I don't know. It's been so long, 50 meters or so. And, dude, all of a sudden you just felt like this, like a thud. And I kind of looked and you couldn't see anything. You just see all like dirt. Once that cleared, man, this 20,000 pound vehicle was on its roof.
No way.
It was sitting on two 500 pounders, killed guys inside, and we're still like now we're starting to take like effective mortar fire and stuff like that. And we left that day with we lost that one, you know. So
was that whenever, what year was that, do you think?
2010.
So 2010, I know that there was like a big revamp of the way that like vehicles were designed.
Yeah,
to take IEDs.
We were done with Humvees. However, man, those things, I still seen these Mat Vs and Max Pros, that's what they're called, just freaking twisted. That's 1,000 pounds of detonation, you know.
That seems like it would be the worst part. Like, that's, to me, like, never knowing.
That's where a lot of my anxiety comes from, is from being on that road and having to drive down it so far and just knowing, like, how many IEDs have gone off, you know, and you're just like, just get me out of this thing. I just want to dismount and walk, you know.
Yeah.
Because so, we ended up, not us, but like an engineer company had to come in and actually create like a side road for us to keep going further and further because that one was just so bad. And we would get so far up, man, they would plant them behind us.
Really?
Yeah.
So you guys were pushing in territory that nobody else had
absolutely
been in yet?
Yeah. Yep.
Let's jump back. What was it like coming out of high school and going into boot camp? What was that like?
It was a shock. I mean, you know, nobody can prepare you for boot camp. You know, it's a whole different thing. Yeah. But like we talked about earlier, man, being a wrestler, like, it's not
I'll run, I'll PT. I'll throw up.
You can't
keep going.
You can't smoke a rock, you know, like the good old phrase. But, I mean, it was cool. I excelled. I was proud. And you know, it was just good old Army infantry boot camp. So,
do you remember at, like, 18? I guess you'd be at about 18 at that point, making the decision to go join, like, in the middle of wartime.
Yeah. So, it's funny, man. I actually kind of bounced around for, like, a year or two after I graduated, just being a knucklehead. And I actually turned 21 in boot camp. I'll never forget it. I remember doing push-ups, and I just was thinking, God, I hope these drill sergeants don't find out it's my 21st birthday. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you go through boot camp, you said you excelled, and how long after boot camp did you immediately get deployed?
Well, I went to airborne school.
Okay.
Had a Ranger contract, got in trouble at airborne school.
What'd you do?
Honestly, all I did was not come back. I stayed out past curfew.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but some of the guys I was with got into a fight with each other. I swear to God, I didn't do anything. I was just there watching it. And some civilians saw it and broke it up. And the first sergeant, whoever, of airborne school called us in the next day and was like, you're getting new orders.
Really?
And we had already done all the training and everything. I was supposed to jump that weekend. So that weekend, I'm freaking watching my buddies jump. And I'm like, gosh, dang it, you know. But, I mean, it is what it is. Everything happens for a reason. I got sent to 10th Mountain and deployed a couple months later.
Really?
Yeah.
So you deployed, you said Afghanistan, and what was the province again?
It was Kunduz, up north.
Okay, so northern Afghanistan. Yeah. At that point, what was the overall kind of outlook in Afghanistan? Like, I can't remember. That was, what year was it? 2010. 2010?
Yeah.
What were things like in Afghanistan at that point?
Chaos, I would say. I mean, when we first got there, in Kunduz, it was tiny. We just had HESCO barriers filled with dirt. They're, I don't know, 8-9 feet tall with wire on the top of them and sleeping in tents.
Really?
Yep. Yeah, it was a FOB, forward observation base. So,
yeah.
Man. Yeah.
So when you deployed, since you were, I guess, did you have a strong relationship with the guys that you deployed with since you weren't originally with that?
For sure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you get super tight with those guys when you deploy with them.
So after you left Ranger school, how long did you have?
I didn't get
school,
to go.
Airborne school. How long did you have with the...
Just a few months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had enough time to really start to get to know dudes and build those relationships and stuff.
Yep.
Man.
Yeah.
Do you remember the thought process of your first couple of days in Afghanistan? Like, what were you thinking?
Yeah, I was like, let's go.
Yeah.
I was like, let's go get some, you know? And it's just so hard to describe, man. Like, being somewhere so far away and seeing how people live and just knowing, like, anybody that's been there, they'll understand what I'm saying, but it's hard to explain, man. You know, like, even to this day, like, on a summer night or something, a certain breeze or something, like, it'll just take you back, you know.
Really?
Like, if it's real dark and real quiet, like, it's wild. But I was ready. I was like, let's get it.
Do you remember your first, contact? The first time you guys went out and had contact?
Yeah, it was that. The first time we took contact was that one with the truck in front of me that got blown up. Yeah.
Oh, what an introduction.
Welcome. Yeah. You got like 10 more months of this, buddy.
Is that how long was your deployment?
It was just shy of a year.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. So 10 more months. So you're almost like a month or almost 2 months in.
Got my CIB within a few weeks, combat infantry badge. That's what every infantryman lives for, you know.
Really?
Because that means you've earned.
You actually did something.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
So run me through like those 10 months. Like that was your 2 months in. Run me through the rest of it.
You know, we would go out for a while, come back and, you know, take a few days off, go back out. And then that's when we had a really, really big push to take over Ishikan, Gortempa. That was like a whole company push. That was something. But, man, I remember, you know, you'd go out to the trucks at like 02 and you'd get dropped off. It felt like hours later. You don't know where you're at. You're just rucking with probably 100 pounds on because you don't know how long you're going to be out, how long you're going to be gone. I mean, man, you would ruck for hours and hours and hours, and then all of a sudden you'd get into a firefight in some little village. And then if you didn't have CAS, close air support, like Apaches, it was on. But as soon as the Apaches showed up, man, it was like, all right, I can just chill because they're going to smoke everybody, and these guys are going to hide because you can't run from the Apaches, man. But as soon as they left to go refuel, you're like, here it goes, you know.
Really?
So yeah.
It's almost like timed. Yeah. Like, all right, well, let's chill. The Apaches are here.
Yeah.
And then pretty as soon much. As they leave, really.
I remember one night, it was starting to get dark, and this was part of that village we were taking over, and we had some contact and stuff. We had a guy across the river on a PKM, and we were kind of separated, just kind of like holding ground, and I was sitting there by myself, just wore out, sitting there holding my saw, machine gunner, and it was getting dark. There was an Apache like flying like right here. I was like, God, please know I'm a friendly. Please know I'm a friendly. And man, he's just freaking lighting up these Hellfire missiles. The wildest thing, one of the wildest things I've ever heard. Really? And it just destroying people, man. Yeah,
goodness.
Yeah,
man. So after you like get into like a firefight like that, do you guys stay out there?
Yeah,
and then.
Yeah,
I'm guessing eventually you like make entry into the village.
You stay out there, man. You know, that one we were in. Every morning, man, it was like clockwork. You would hear the lobs. You'd hear the mortars get launched over. And then one morning, we didn't take any contact or anything, and so we started pushing forward. It was just my platoon and over. A couple clicks over here to the whatever direction that was third platoon. We had pushed up. There was like a open brick factory. It's not like buildings, like what people think. It's just like a field with a bunch of bricks everywhere. And it was my team leader, my grenadier, which is a rifleman with a grenade launcher, and then me. We were kind of a little bit away from the rest of our platoon. We were kind of sitting along these ruins, and I remember you would hear like a 3-round burst, and then you'd see it was a Mark 19 grenade launcher, automatic grenade launcher, and then they would land, and you're like, it's like 150 meters away, whatever, you know. A few minutes later, you'd hear it again.
Well, and then 75.
Those landed a little bit closer, yeah. And then the next time was right on us. It was, I think, the guys that saw it, was like 15 feet from where we were sitting. Three of them just boom, hit us pretty good, rattled us three pretty good. And I just remember like hearing screaming, you know. Come to find out, it was like my platoon sergeant. I guess from what it looked like, he probably assumed the worst for us three. when we came out, man, there was nothing tactical about it. It was like a 200, from what I remember, a 100 or 200 meter run straight back to where we had better cover. That was when they opened up. I was like, man, I just remember thinking like this, I'm going to get shot in the back. Luckily we made it. And I remember one of my buddies who was a prior medic. He was now a grunt. He was looking at me. He's like, you know, cause there's visual signs of head trauma, you know, like raccoon eyes and stuff like that. And it is what it is. He said that. And guess what? We're still out there, you know. I mean, I ain't dead. Still in the fight. you know? So it is what it is.
I guess one of my questions that I have for guys that went overseas like that, that I never really had asked anybody is, so you go out there and you like prepare for this contact, you get into a firefight, dudes are trying to blow you up, and then you guys end up most likely taking over the village, and then now you have to go like live like next to these people.
Yeah.
What was that like?
I was sleeping in the dirt, just sleeping. And honestly, man, it was actually a pretty rewarding feeling, because eventually, you know, we would run that over, and our interpreter would tell us, like, the civilians are happy. Like, you see kids out playing. You know, they would say thank you and Dari or Pashto, whatever language it was. And that was rewarding, man, because those are innocent people, and these dudes are just punks killing women and children, and you know, like, we had a militia that would come out with us called the Arbaki, and a lot of those guys were, their families have been murdered and stuff by,
really?
Yeah, so they were out for blood, you know. But it's just crazy over there. It's, yeah,
I remember, I think it was like Marcus Luttrell was talking about like the difference in culture. And he talked about how after he got, like, after the guys came in and, like, recovered him, mm-hmm. that they gave, like, a kid a water bottle. Mm-hmm. And the kid, like, poured the water bottle out and played with it like it was a toy. Oh,
dude, it's unbelievable. You know, I remember we would go out to these villages, and the way I can describe it is, you know, like, if you're at a lake or a pond or something, and there's that fish food machine, and you get food out, and all the fish are sitting there waiting, and you throw it, and all of a sudden it's just like fish going crazy. That's how it was every time these kids would see you over a water bottle, over an MRE. You know, it's sad. That's Christmas for them, you know.
So the villages that you guys were pushing into, how large were they?
They were large, man, but they were spread out, you know. I don't know. It's kind of hard to answer, but they were just weird layouts. You know, like, it'd be a compound over here, compound over here. You'd have to clear all that stuff out, you know.
Man. Other than that last firefight that you talked about where you nearly got blown up, are there any other times that really stick out to you that, like,
yeah, that same mission, actually, I don't know if it was before or after that incident. 3rd Platoon had taken some casualties, and I don't know who came over. It was my squad leader. It was my team leader, me, another SAW gunner, and a couple of scout guys. So there was probably like 5 or 6 of us, and we literally were told to get the Taliban's attention, from what I remember. So the problem is that 3rd Platoon was taking so much contact, the Blackhawks couldn't land and take out the casualties. So we freaking just bound across this big old open brick area, get to this trench where we're laying, start shooting and stuff, and eventually the Blackhawks were able to land and get those guys out. But man, I'll never forget it. I remember running, and the Blackhawk wasn't that high, and I just remember looking up, and I could see the rotors, you know. That's that auditory exclusion. But what happened, which was messed up again on that same little mission, was, so we're there, you know, we're in the trench now, like, trying to take fires for 3rd Platoon so those guys could get out. And we start pulling back. Some idiots in headquarters platoon who were behind us with some mortar guys started damn near lobbing mortars right on top of us because the Taliban started coming closer. So, yeah, that happened. And then we finally get back where we get in these compounds where we meet up with 3rd Platoon. And now the Taliban were in the trench that we were just in, and that luckily we had close air support, and they just fucking smoked those guys.
Really?
So I think about that sometimes. I'm like, dude, we could have been scrapping, or who knows, you know?
Yeah, that would have been insane, like World War One type stuff.
You'd have won. Fixed bayonets.
You know what's crazy is you So I interviewed Joe Judge. He's one of my friends, and he was a saw gunner as well. And he's like, you guys are built identical to each other. It's like they must like identify like, you.
Why me? I got short legs. Yeah. Give it to this freaking.
Short jack, dude. Yeah. Take this gun.
I'm like, this is performance punishment.
Yeah. Man, it's so crazy. What's bizarre to me is like, just from like watching documentaries, and I've always been intrigued. We talked like I've always been intrigued with the military, and it's so crazy how well equipped. Like this is where these people have lived their entire lives, mm-hmm. and how well they can navigate the mountains mm-hmm. and move so quickly. And like you said, you know, you're carrying around 100-pound
pack because
this is where you're like this isn't you're not from here,
right?
You know, you don't know how long you're going to be here,
right?
It's like you're trying to navigate these same mountains that these dudes are running around in sandals in.
The exact. It's just you're at such a disadvantage, you know. Like, so this guy, I give it to them, man. They know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're not as dumb as people think.
Yeah, just the ability to like navigate that area so quickly, and
mm-hmm.
it's just crazy how, you know. Like you know, like right now you're in the middle of the United States.
Yeah.
You're literally in the middle in Missouri.
We're, right.
You know, years ago climbing some mountain in Afghanistan.
Right.
You know,
it's so nuts. Yeah.
I posted something on social media the other day and it made me think about you because we have talked previously about like the brotherhood
mm-hmm.
that you end up building with like these guys that's forged in violence and war, you know. What was it like, you know, how like the relationship that you built with these guys, like do you still communicate with a lot of them or?
Sadly, no, I communicate with just a few. It's weird.
Yeah. What was it like going into battle with those dudes? Like, cause I think of it on the police side of things, like the guys that, you know, the guys that I really trust and the guys that I'll do, you know, search warrants with. And it's like, you build this bond mm-hmm. that's kind of like,
it's there's no words.
It's hard to like explain to other people, like knowing that the guy next to you, like, hey man, we're about to go kick this dude
or
kick this door down, and this dude's in there and he just did all this crazy stuff. It's like, you good? It's like, yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, that's how it is. I mean, you trust the guy to your left and your right with your life, and he does the same, and there's no questions asked, you know. Like, you know, you're both gonna die for each other, you're gonna kill for each other, like simple as that, and then you just go.
Yeah. How far in the deployment was that last fight you just talked about?
I think that was probably 3/4 of the way in, if I remember correctly.
That's always a weird thing for me, too, is like, were you counting down the days? Like, at some point, were you like, okay, well, I got this much time left. I got this much time left.
I think I was counting down the days more of when I got to go on my, like, 2-week leave, because I think I did that, like, in the winter time.
Yeah. When you're on that 2-week leave, were there parts of you that wanted to be back in Afghanistan?
For sure, man. For sure. Like, it's such a crazy feeling, you know, like, say you're out on a mission or something and, you know, everything's cool, but you hear, you know, another platoon or the scout platoon's in a firefight, and, man, you just want to be able to teleport and get over there and help them, you know? Like, it's – so, yeah, when you're not there, it's like, damn, dude, like, hope, you know what I mean? So same, it's the same feeling when the Michael Brown crap happened. You know, I was in Riverview my first time as a cop, and that was chaos. And, you know, Riverview was a small department, and there was only like 2 of us on it. You know, hearing stuff coming over the radio, like officers taking fire and stuff. It's like
that radio traffic was
insane.
Dude,
I was like freaking out. Like I wanted to get there so bad, but I had a coward sergeant at the time who was scared of whatever, you know, so.
Yeah, it's weird because it's like the fear of missing out. Like,
yeah.
In the police world, it's like, oh, they had this hot call last night. It's like, man.
Yeah, FOMO.
Yeah, like
of hot calls.
Yeah, like, yeah. Man, I wish I would have been there. Like,
exactly.
I wish, you know, Loki and I could have been on that call.
Heck,
we changed
yeah.
the outcome of it or whatever. But
yeah.
So what was the rest of that deployment like?
Pretty much like that, man. Just going out, doing missions. Once we established that checkpoint in those villages, we stayed there. Till we left seat, right seat, till whoever came in and started replacing us, which I don't know what happened, man. Years ago, it all got taken back over, so pointless.
Really?
Yep. FOB, the checkpoints, everything.
Really? I guess that's like a weird thing, too, for guys that went over and sacrificed so much. It's like to see where it is now.
It was for nothing.
What's going on?
Yeah. That's what it feels like.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Just seems so difficult to swallow, you know, because I know you and I know that you like did sacrifice a lot. And I know that there's a lot of things that happened over there that, you know, to this day still, mm-hmm. you know, connect with you. And just to hear you say like it was for nothing.
It was. It
makes me want to pick this mic stand up and smash it across something.
It was. You know,
it's crazy. What was it like? For you, like, was there any time in that whole thing where somebody that you were really close to got injured or anything like that?
Try to make it through this part.
You can cry, dude. I cry all the time on this.
So not everybody can leave at the same time. You know, you just take turns of leaving, and I was already home. And
when you say leave, you mean like you were done?
Yeah.
Like your deployment was over?
Yeah. So the new unit or whatever was coming in and replacing us. One of my good buddies, Tony, he come to my barracks door one day and told me that Wade got shot. And we're like, oh, shit. You know, we didn't really know the extent of it. And we were keeping tabs with his family, so they flew him out to Germany, and it was like 24 hours. He was on life support, and his family had to pull the plug from Antioch, Illinois, which is just north of Chicago. Man, I remember like being with Tony, being in one of our barracks room when we found out, dude, like couldn't breathe, couldn't like. I just remember like walking outside, just like, dude, like there's just couldn't do anything. Ended up being one of his pallbearers, which was tough. Yeah, it sucked. We lost decent guys on that year. And then the next year, when I was actually in the academy, my unit deployed again. Another buddy of mine, Maddox, he was working at the gate ECP entry control point when a vehicle came and he got blown up, and 97% of his body was burnt. You're not going to survive that. So he died in Germany too. I remember being in the academy probably like during con law or something stupid like that and finding that out. That was shitty. And I've actually lost a couple buddies to suicide since then. So,
just we were talking about that brotherhood earlier, and like those relationships are forged in such a difficult environment, mm-hmm. and it's hard to find dudes that you can really connect to like that. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Part of 1078 is to try and create some of those relationships again. You know, like you're now part of a group that,
right.
You know, we have the opportunity to interact with a bunch of other guys that, you know, have been through similar incidents to us, and like. I think sometimes the only people that I feel like understand some of the thoughts that I have or some of the thoughts that you have are dudes that have been through the same thing.
For sure.
So it's like losing those dudes that you were so connected to is like swallowing the hardest pill. And I think the even harder part of it is to leave and then start losing dudes to suicide mm-hmm. is even more difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, like in war, people are lost, and that doesn't make it any easier, I guess, but it also, you know, at least you feel like they died for like a purpose, and like they were on a mission and they had a goal.
Like my buddy Wes, Wesley Sykes, man, him and I were so tight. He lived with me in my barracks room. He was married, but whatever, all that, whatever. So he technically couldn't have a barracks room, but he lived with me for a long time after deployment. Man, we were inseparable, work out, freaking go to Alexandria Bay, like the Great Lakes and stuff. And just so close, dude, and it's such a shitty thing because, you know, we kind of drifted apart after we both got out, and like 2 years ago, man, I knew he was a father and fucking killed himself. You know, it's like I'll get pictures at him all the time, and I think like, dude, what if I just stayed in contact with him? You know, maybe I could have helped him, or he could have called me, or so.
Yeah. That's a hard burden to put on yourself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a difficult place to put yourself in, you know, like it's one of those things. It's like sometimes I just wonder, you know, it's like, I wonder how we get to that point, you know, like yeah. at what point do we get to the point that we're like, well, there's nothing really left here, you
right.
know, like to make that decision. It's like, I don't know.
Well, I know a few times, man, only thing that kept me is I believe in heaven and hell, and I don't want to take that chance of,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I don't want to think of any of my friends not in heaven because they took their own lives. But as a Catholic, I mean, that's mm-hmm. what you know. So
leaving the military, did you struggle at all? Like when you left?
Yeah, I did for a while, man. Because you're such a part of something, and then you come home and ended up getting my own house and lived with a couple buddies every now and then. But, I mean, I have a really good older sister. My oldest sister, Lori, she's like a mom to me, you know. Mm-hmm. Her and my brother-in-law, Nick, really, really helped me get through some shit. And so did my dog.
Yeah.
Yeah. Love dogs. Yeah. Yep. Old Rocco. Yeah. Yep. Named him after my papa.
That makes sense, though. It's like you leave like something where you feel like you have such a sense of purpose and,
yeah.
And such a connection to other people. And then you just come yeah. home and you're just like, hey, man, go get a job at Lowe's.
Right. You know what I mean? You also feel like an outcast because you come home and like the little things will set you off. Like, not like you're crazy, nothing like that, but like it's called first world problems. Like mm-hmm. even with some of my nephews at the time, I would get pissed because they would bitch over, I don't know, I'm just making an example, a video game or something. And you're like, if you could just go over to a third world war-torn country and see how these kids live, you know. So you have issues with people bitching about the littlest things in the greatest country, you know, and they just don't get it.
Yeah.
And it just that's what infuriates you the most, you know.
Yeah, dude. I was just talking to Mark about this earlier. Is like when my wife and I first started dating, she would like freak out about like the simplest things. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I had been a cop for a little while, and I'm like,
yeah.
Did anybody die today?
Exactly.
Like, did anybody die today?
Yep. And
she's like, no. I'm like, then it's not that big of
exactly.
a deal.
Exactly.
Chill out.
Yeah.
Like, everything will be all right.
Yeah.
And like, she doesn't make it any easier for her.
Yeah.
But I can understand that, like, hey, man, like, there's bigger and deeper things that are going on right
that's
now.
Right.
Like, if the worst thing is the lady at Chick-fil-A gave exactly. you a small fry instead of a large fry,
yeah,
like, maybe we should reconsider what we're really upset about.
Yep. Amen to that.
And I think, again, it's like one of those things, like, the normal dude that hasn't been in the military and doesn't do, like, a, you know, public service type job, a guy that works at, you know, I don't know, some random accounting mm-hmm. firm, it's hard for him to grasp those same mm-hmm. concepts.
Absolutely.
So leaving the military and moving over to the law enforcement world, do you feel like you were kind of seeking that brotherhood a little bit?
For
and
sure.
Like that sense of purpose again?
For sure. Yeah.
How long between when you left the military to when you like got into the academy?
Got off active duty February 13 and was in the academy May of 13.
Oh, so quick.
Yeah.
Quick.
Yeah.
You didn't want to sit around.
No.
Yeah. Had to keep it moving.
Yeah.
What was the academy like to you?
A joke.
Did you go? Where'd you go?
Eastern.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It, especially coming from like.
I mean, I was still pretty fresh off being active duty and, you know, being in good shape and just, you know, I was just like, whatever. Let's just get done with this stuff.
Yeah.
Set the push-up record.
You did?
I did.
How many was it?
Oh, shit. What was it? 110 or?
110 push-ups. And how long was it? I can't remember. It was just without stopping.
You couldn't rest.
Yeah. So was, like, lifting and stuff, was that, like, always a big part of your life?
Oh, yeah. Dude, I remember being a little kid, and my dad would be in the bedroom working out because he didn't have money to go to a gym and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, just instilled it in me from day one, man. Like, now I the older I get, it's like, well, one, being a police officer, I can't stand these freaking soft ass out of shape cops. It's like, you have an obligation and a duty to freaking protect and serve people, and you can't fight out of a wet paper bag. Like, dude, that shit infuriates me. So I really feel like your body's a weapon, mm-hmm. and you should train as such. And you can't always rely on your tools and everything like that. Like you gotta know how to use these and everything else. Like if I'm walking down the street someday with my wife and son, you know, I feel pretty confident that I'm going to be able to protect them with mm-hmm. or without a gun, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, training, you know, wrestling, grappling, jujitsu, that's important, you know, lifting yeah. weights is important.
Yeah. So, I also just for like your mental stability, yeah. you know, like for me, I want to work out, so that way, you know, if something ever happened, I have the ability to like, you know, defend myself. But also for me, it's just been like a good way to like take some time off yeah. of the, like hit the gym, take some time to myself, spend an hour and a half or an hour in the gym. Yeah. yeah and just kind of not think about anything other yeah. than just picking this heavy thing up and putting it back
yeah.
down.
No, know? Same here. It's definitely a mental escape, you yeah. know.
I have to work out. Yes. I think we were texting the other day.
Yeah, we were. Yeah. You were all sideways. You hadn't yeah. worked out in a few days.
Yeah, like getting so angry. I'm like anxious because I hadn't hit the gym in yeah. a couple days. It's like the only way that I like stay on my baseline.
Well, it's proven. I mean, it releases endorphins and stuff, yeah. you know. So
so you joined the academy. What year was that now? It's like you're like
May of 13.
13?
Yeah.
So, okay, so you started in the police academy about a year and a half after me. So it was still really, really competitive. Like
yeah.
law enforcement was ultra competitive.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you have somewhere where you wanted to start?
So, no. I knew I wanted to start on that side of the river, and I just got lucky. And the, you know, old Fred?
Yeah, yeah.
Old Fred Sabaka or whatever. Yeah. He pulled closer towards the end of the academy, pulled me in his office.
Well, he was like an Army guy too, wasn't he? Or
Air Force,
something yeah. like that.
He
did a couple deployments.
Yeah, he pulled me in his office. He's like, hey, Riverview's looking for a guy, blah, blah, blah. I was like, oh, okay, sure. Like, so I started off as a reserve, actually, in Riverview, and then started working there. But yeah, man, I remember it'd be 50, 60 guys for one or two jobs, you know. Yeah. Nowadays, It's
like 50 or 60 jobs and one or two guys.
That's right.
You know what I mean? Right. It's insane.
That's right, man.
Starting off in Riverview, for people that aren't like familiar with the area, Riverview yeah. is in like North St. Louis County mm-hmm. area. Pretty rough area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you remember, you said you started off as a reserve. Did you still go through like normal field training or how did they work that?
Gave me a keys to a car and
really
threw me on the street.
No.
I swear.
No, dude.
I promise you.
Seriously?
Yeah.
You had no formal field training?
No. Maybe for a couple weeks. I should take that back. I'm sorry. But I do remember one day they just threw me in a car without having any training. But then it wasn't like no 3 months, 2 months, nothing really? Like that. Yeah. My first FTO was actually Sean Winground. He's a good buddy of mine.
Yeah, I know him.
Yeah, he's actually now back at Lincoln County. He's detached in the Marshals.
Yeah, canine handler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. He was my first FTO ever.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and good old Riverview. Yeah.
How big was Riverview?
It's tiny. It's like a square mile.
Really?
Yeah.
How many cops worked there?
At the time, there would only be like a couple of us on the road, and then after 2 a.m., you'd be by yourself. But Bell Fountain was
yeah,
right
you're
there.
Like a bunch of mutual yeah. aid. So if something really hot popped off. Do you remember your first hot call?
Yeah, I almost shot a chick. Got a call for a domestic. Pull up, and some ladies outside, like, y'all better hurry up. They're fighting, blah, blah, blah. So I go in, you know, I have my gun out, and there's a chick standing in the kitchen, like, just 2 feet from this guy, and she's got a freaking knife in her hand. And I could see he was all already sliced up.
No way.
Man, I was freaking putting the pressure on that trigger, and she ended up dropping the knife, but so that was that. There's shootings.
Did the dude live?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember having a quadruple shooting one time at good old, what was that, Lilac and Chambers? Yeah, Diamond and Chambers. People know that area. It's a freaking.
It's a wild place.
Yeah,
it's a wild place.
Yeah.
Did you find what you were looking for in law enforcement when you joined? Did you find that, like, brotherhood mm-hmm. and that?
Yeah. Yep, pretty quick.
Yeah, and I think it's, like, again, I think it's just something about that forged in, it like, is. Your willingness to go to war with somebody
Absolutely.
That, like, builds those relationships. I think it's hard to find that elsewhere.
It is, very hard.
leaving the military and then jumping into law enforcement, did you do anything? Like, did the military run you through, like, any post-deployment stuff? Or, like, did you get any, like, help or anything like that?
No, I mean, you just go through, it's called out processing. You just go through, like, hey, here's a finance class. Here's a life insurance class. I think when we first came back from deployment, you, like, went through a little medical eval, but, I mean, it was kind of whatever.
Yeah.
And back then, you know, man, if you missed a PT every morning or any morning to go to for a mental health call or eval, dude, you kiss your freaking career goodbye.
Really?
Oh yeah, man. If you were missing training or PT because you needed to go see a mental doctor or anything, bro,
it's over.
You're done. Yeah. You ain't going nowhere.
That's great.
You know, like, yeah, fuck that. You know, like, you know, and it's a pride thing too. You know, you're like, I don't want to be a little bitch.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Sure. So.
Well, that, like, a lot of those are like law enforcement is very paramilitary, and that's still very true. You know what I mean?
It
like,
is.
If you know, and that's it's such like what we do here is like such a like subculture.
Yeah.
And like it's cool to have other like guys that are like meat eaters. Like I consider you like a meat eater.
Yeah.
It's to see like, hey man, there is like a need for this and we should probably address these things.
Right.
Because sometimes I feel like I'm like out on the island. People are like, oh, you're soft. I'm like, I promise I'm a real cop.
Exactly.
Like, I still want to catch bad guys. Yes. I just think that maybe, you know, after you get into a shooting or you kill somebody, right, we should probably address that a little bit. You know,
like, yeah.
We should probably do something about that.
Right.
So there was like no formal process. So you went from, first off, did you think you got a TBI whenever?
I think I got something as time goes on. Man, I have no memory. It's hard for me to memorize anything. I'll stutter sometimes. Can't get my thoughts out.
And you relate that back to the time you guys got not mortared, but
Yeah. That and
I don't know what the couple right other terms, grenaded. I mean,
even just, you know, even the, you know, what's the word when it's something detonates like the
I know what you're talking
the
about,
blast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if you're not directly hit, like you're, I don't know, or I'm just dumb. I don't know, or I'm just getting dumber the older I get. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. I think I can't remember the term that you're talking about, but I know what you're talking about. Where like that energy has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's gonna go.
Yeah.
You know, into all that soft tissue.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's been plenty of guys that have gotten blown up that weren't actually blown up that force has like destroyed their insides, you know, like that energy just, it's escaping and it's escaping fast and it's going to take whatever it can.
It's a lot stronger than the human body, you know?
Yeah. So I think there's definitely some truth to that. And, did you like no medical, nothing?
Nope.
Really?
Yep.
I guess like the thing I think that is the craziest to me, cause I've only been in law enforcement, I've never been in the military, is like, I was talking to Joe and he's like, well, it's just back to business the next day. He's just like,
yeah,
it's like nobody pulled you to the side and like, hey man, this dude just got blown up yesterday. Something may be going on. We should probably let him chill for a second. Just
not
back to business, dude. And he's like, you're in a foreign country, man. You don't have time to do that.
Yeah. That's you're there to fight, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's insane to me. But again, I was never in the military. Probably there's a reason why most people in the military are young.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the reason why you know you're 21 years old and you're doing it.
Yeah.
Now with like family life and kiddos and stuff, like you're a lot less likely to run into silly stuff. But so you start at Riverview, and you said you quickly found that brotherhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that and just I guess I was still adrenaline junkie, man. You know, I still wanted to do all that crazy stuff.
How long were you there?
I think like almost 2 years.
Okay, so you spent a decent
year and a half, something like that. Yeah.
And then you eventually leave.
Yeah, did a little bit of time at Normandy under your chief.
Yeah.
He was a chief at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then Woodson Terrace, where I was there for a while.
Is that Halstead?
Yeah,
the chief.
It was. It started when I got there. It was Chief Mayberry. And then Halstead, and now it's Chief Orlando.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the reason for leaving departments?
Well, you know, I didn't know any better at the time, but because I was fresh, I was new to police work and stuff. I mean, it's Riverview, and what is there to offer?
Mm-hmm.
Their PD's a freaking double wide.
Is it really?
Yeah, dude. Like, why would I stay there? You know, and went to Normandy, so that was pretty fresh after, or not fresh, but it was, you know, after all the Michael Brown crap, you know, so I'll just say it like it is. They wanted you to make sure you hit every street in your sector, blah, 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 each shift. I'm like, fuck this. Like, I'm here to do police work. I mean, yeah, you got to patrol, but you get on people's ass for not hitting a street or sitting in a certain spot at a certain time. I was like, this is stupid. Couldn't really do anything proactive. So I was like, and then I was reached out to by some guys at Woodson and went there.
So pre to post Ferguson, what was that like working in St. Louis County?
Oh, it sucked. It sucked. I mean, I'm a white male. I'm automatically racist. Oh, let me throw this camera in your face. All these smart ass comments like, don't shoot me in my hand, you know, just typical crap. You know, you're like, dude, you don't know me from a can of paint. Yeah. You know, like, I don't see skin. I see either you're a good person or you're not a good person. Yeah. Simple as that, you know.
I guess that'd probably be pretty hard to swallow, too, like, knowing that you just went overseas, yeah, you lost friends, you worked your butt off for a country, and then you come back.
You served with people of all cultures, all race, all walks of life, you know. We all came from God, like, just because you have more melatonin in your skin don't mean we're different, you know?
Yeah.
I'm Sicilian. You know, I got down somewhere in the history of Sicilian culture, there's black culture. Mm-hmm. You know, there's Middle Eastern culture and Sicilian blood. So it's like, people that think like that are just worthless, you know?
Yeah. It is such a weird, broken way to think. It's like the further and further we separate ourselves from each other,
mm-hmm,
you know, it's like, is that really how you want to look at people?
It's baffling that there's people that think like that. You know,
I think the good thing is that, you know, like, if you're a Christian, it doesn't, you know, like, God created everyone.
Exactly.
Right? So, like, doesn't matter to me who you're created or who you are now. It's like you were created in the image of God.
That's right.
Like, if it's good enough for God, it's good enough for me. That's right. I don't have any problem with any of that.
Yeah.
I didn't even ask you, like, being deployed and growing up Catholic, like, what was that? How did you navigate your relationship with God as you're going through all of that?
I just really felt like we were there doing the right thing. I mean, like I said, the Taliban would murder women and children. And I'm like, dude, God don't stand for that. Like, mm-hmm, he put us here to freaking get rid of those people, you know? But that's the problem, I think, in society is people think being a Christian, being Catholic, oh, everything's lovey-dovey. But know what? God put guys on this planet like you and me to freaking go toe-to-toe with Satan and his little punks. And if we got to kill one of them, we got to kill one of them.
Yeah, I think we all have like this really weird, well, society has this really weird like idea of Jesus. Like, you know, it's like this super emasculated man. It's like the same Jesus that you're talking about is the same one who flipped tables and cracked whips, you know,
right?
What I mean?
Like, exactly,
that's the same Jesus that you're talking
that's
about,
right,
you know,
that's right.
It's not, you know, Jesus wasn't some like super non-masculine,
that's right, man, you know, absolutely,
like, he had passion and
he's got it. Yeah, people don't get it. Yeah. You know.
Yeah. Bouncing around, where did you end up finding home?
Woodson. For a while, for about 6 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was it like there?
It was good, man. I loved it. I had a great command staff. Had some really good sergeants there. It was a good atmosphere. It was go be a cop, you know. Got the opportunity to go into the St. Louis County Drug Unit, which was a task force at the time. So I was cross-deputized by the FBI and the U.S. Marshals. Man, that was, I don't think I'll ever have that kind of fun again as a cop, unless I go back into that unit, you know, doing undercover stuff, doing crazy dope cases, just going out to the first precinct, going out to Jennings, and literally just being told to just stir the pot, violent crime initiative, VCI, you just go do surveillance on like all these hot areas, man. And you have the bird up and freaking just vehicle assault dudes and you know, just crazy shit. I mean, over there, man, in that unit, especially the guys on the street team, dude, they could be in a shooting every single day, literally. Yeah. Every single day, those dudes could be in a shooting. They're just so good at spiking cars and taking dudes down. But I'm telling you, man, every day you could be in a shooting in that unit.
Yeah, run me through one of your critical things there.
Yeah, I mean, to somebody over here that's never been over there, or like, you know, somebody that's worked at, I don't know, just let's say Cottleville, you know, never really done police work, dude, you would think everything was a critical incident over there, you know.
Yeah.
Smashing dudes' windows out, ripping them out of cars, you know, to us over there, that's normal. Mm-hmm. But anyways, first shooting I was in Jennings. We got a call. Well, not we. So a lot of times you being in that unit, man, you were sent out to do some shit, you know, just because you have the ability to. You're not in uniform. You're not in a marked car. You know what I mean? So mm-hmm. you have the element of surprise, which is better, you know. I always tell people, man, being in patrol, that's the most dangerous job. You're in uniform, you're walking up to a house, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So anyways, had a call. Well, we got briefed on this guy. He broke into like his ex-girlfriend's house, and he was crazy, man. Some piece of crap that was out on parole, mind you. There's our justice system for everybody listening. So this violent dude's out on parole, breaks into his girlfriend's house. From what I remember, he had Pornhub pulled up on his phone, and he was yelling at this gal saying, "That's you." And she's like, "What are you? You're crazy. Like, you're watching Pornhub. I'm not cheating on you." Whatever. I think he roughed her up, and I'm almost certain that I was told he held a machete to, like, the daughter's throat, like, acting like he was going to kill the daughter. And then steals a gun from her and then goes and find out that he's in his mom's house in Jennings. So we get set up. The lot's on a corner. So it's right here. So I'm back here, kind of on the backside watching one of my best friends, Ryan. He's down on the other side, and he's watching the front. And so there's a total of four of us. I had a guy in my front seat and Ryan and Kyle in their seat. So like 45 minutes go by, nothing, you know, no change. And then this red Jeep pulls up, doesn't pull in the driveway. It pulls parallel to the house and sits there for like 3 minutes and then pulls off. And, you know, that's sort of like, okay, it's probably counter surveillance, you know? So he pulls off, drives past me. Obviously we stay put. There's other detectives in the area that kind of follow and keep eyes on him, circles the neighborhood, comes back, pulls into the driveway, gets out. It's not our target. Starts walking into the front door. Well, Ryan, he had eyes on the front. He says, "Hey, our target is now outside," gives a description, clothing and all that. He says he's kind of looking around. He goes back inside with this other unidentified male. And then Ryan says, "Now all the blinds are closed." So literally like a minute later, I see this gal come out the back door of the house, and she walks to this little detached garage, gets her car out, and now she pulls down the street parallel to the house again where the Jeep was a few minutes ago. And I don't know, very, very short time later, the guy comes out, our target comes out. So we're like, "Hey, let's let him get to the car. Like, let's let him get pulling on the door handle that way.
He doesn't get back into the house." Right.
So, boom, freaking, we start closing in, man. And dude's not running yet. And I bumper lock her in. So I come in nose to nose on her so she can't go nowhere. Joe jumps out. Boom, he addresses her. Well, now he starts running. So I'm chasing him. Ryan's coming in from the front. Comes into the parking, into the driveway. I'm chasing this dude around the front yard. He starts running up the steps, and I mean, we're feet, and he just starts boom, 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 shooting. As he's going into his front door, boom, starts shooting through the door. and as cops, what we have to be responsible for our rounds. So I can't just start
spraying.
Yeah, as bad as I wanted to. So I'm like just button hooking, trying to knock it shot, make it behind the car. He's shooting again. Ryan's car took some rounds. Called out, you know, shots fired. A couple of the TAC boys were in the area assisting us. So Zavorka, he's from St. Louis County TAC, dude, freaking lobs a smoke grenade right in front of the house to screen us, and him and another TAC guy come up. So now we have the house perimeter. Dude, eventually, man, the one guy comes out, surrenders, and then the freaking shooter comes out and surrenders, but I still got to put my handcuffs on.
Did they gas him?
No, he ended up coming out.
You didn't even get gassed?
No. Oh. We didn't have TAC. They weren't all spun up yet. It happened pretty quick. And then there was a female and two juveniles inside the house. And there's a freaking elementary school right across the street. Yeah, and this is the middle of the day. And this dude's out on parole.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, you're like, the fuck, you know? And being in the middle of the day, man, you couldn't just...
Yeah.
You couldn't, you know.
Yeah. Well, you see, like, all these, like, things like 13-year-old kid killed in a drive-by.
Yeah.
It's like those rounds are
right.
All, especially for, you know, for us.
Yeah.
We have to be super accountable.
Exactly.
But, like, just to think that some dude's just spraying backwards. Yeah. Doesn't care where it goes.
Right.
You know, it's like,
my right.
Goodness. Like, you have zero regard.
Zero.
For there's other people out here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I get it. You don't like me. That's fine.
Yeah.
Like, I understand that. Like, I understood that guy getting into law enforcement, that people are not
right.
going to like me.
Yeah.
And somebody, at one point or another in my career, somebody may try and kill me. I got that.
Yeah.
You know, it's understandable. But, like, man, like, there's other people out here.
Exactly, dude. Man.
Like, just spraying off rounds.
It's crazy because when the Crimes Against detectives interviewed that guy down at headquarters, he admitted, I woke up. He's like, I looked out my back window. He's like, I saw that car, which was mine. I was at Impala, tenant out Impala. And then he goes, oh, I looked out my front door and saw Ryan's vehicle. He's like, man, I know those don't belong here. He admitted to everything, man. He admitted to sending the female out to bait us. He admitted to, he goes, well, once you guys didn't take the bait on her, he said, I just grabbed my pistol and said, well, we'll see what happens. And we were so close, man. He goes, man, I remember seeing one of their reflections in the glass doors. I was running up shooting, you know. It's like, you coward.
Man.
You know.
It's like also, like, you don't think, like, there's no such thing as home base, bro. We're not just going to leave.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, this is a freeze tag, homie.
Exactly.
Like, now you're just stuck in this place.
Yeah.
We're going to sit here for 4 hours
right.
until you come
outside.
We know
you're in there.
Yeah.
One way or another, we're going to get your ass.
Yeah, and you just gave us all the tactical advantage.
That's
now.
Right.
I appreciate that.
Yep. Yep.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude. That unit is
bro,
that unit's wild now. Yeah. The 1078 Project Podcast is proudly sponsored by Deemed Fit. Deemed Fit is an activewear and a leisure company created for first responders. Be a part of their movement to instill confidence, motivation, and a willingness to keep pushing forward. Deemed Fit is a first responder owned company looking to help first responders and their friends stay as physically and mentally fit as possible. Stay Deemed Fit.